Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
Whoa,
that's a substantial system. This is our new Student Life Center, and it has many configurations, and we're delighted that it is configured this way this evening because it is a welcoming and cheerful crowd, and I know that all of you will have great joy in this opportunity to hear Dr. Reinhard Selten. And I would also like to welcome you to the first Chancellor's Lecture of this academic year. As you know, the Chancellor's Lecture series brings accomplished and interesting women and men to our campus in order that their knowledge and insight may integrate with that of our students, staff, and faculty, and also with members of the Nashville community. And as Chancellor, I have, of course, the honor of presenting to you today our first Chancellor's Lecture for the 2005-2006 academic year, and that is Nobel Laureate in Economics, Reinhard Selten. Reinhard Selten won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 1994, along with his colleagues John Harsany and John Nash, for their analysis of equilibria in the theory of non-cooperative games. Professor Selten introduced the concepts of subgame perfect and perfect equilibria that excluded non-credible threats from the set of Nash equilibria, thereby reducing the set drastically. Professor Selten's contributions enabled more precise and sensible predictions of the behaviors of games and markets. Over his career, Professor Selten has contributed significantly to the applicability of game theory to economic theory. Professor Selten describes himself as a methodic dualist. Next to his work in normative theory, which presumes a subject to be completely rational, Professor Selten concerns himself also with descriptive theory, which attempts to explain the observed behavior of a subject according to the assumption that the subject's rationality is bound by circumstance and capacity. Professor Selten's experiments, which required subjects to make economic decisions in a controlled environment, effectively introduced experimental economics to Germany. The goal of his research was to construct theories that would more accurately describe and predict a subject's behavior than traditional theory had done up to that particular point. Professor Selten's talk today will dwell in the realm of descriptive theory and will concentrate on bounded rationality. Bounded rationality, by the way, is a central theme in the area of behavioral economics. Bounded rationality designates rational choice, while taking into account the cognitive limitations, both limitations of knowledge and limitation of cognitive capacity of the subject. Bounded rationality takes seriously the limited rationality of human behavior, assuming that it is impossible for a subject to comprehend and analyze all potentially relevant information while making choices. Professor Selten is a professor emeritus at the University of Bonn. He's a fellow of the Econometric Society, a member of the North Rhine-Westphalian Academy of Sciences, a foreign honorary member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and an extraordinary member of the Berlin-Brandenburgian Academy of Sciences. Professor Selten will also present tomorrow afternoon at the Vanderbilt Law School, where he will discuss concepts of stationary equilibrium for experimental 2x2 games. We are pleased, and I can tell you very honored, to welcome him to Vanderbilt. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Reinhard Selten.
I'm very glad about the opportunity to talk to you today, and I hope I can satisfy your expectations. So I will talk about bounded rationality. The mainstream picture of rationality is far away from observed behavior. It is necessary to develop theories of bounded rationality. There are some theories of this kind already worked out, and experimental results support such theories. These are theories of limited range, but an empirical-based general theory remains a task of the future. And only little of what is known will be presented here, I concentrate on selected topics. The term bounded rationality will be used here, understood in the This will be understood in the tradition of Herbert A. Simon as the bounded rationality exhibited by real people, not something, some ideal rationality like the rationality of economic man, but the rationality exhibited by actual behavior. And the mainstream picture of rationality is far away from observed behavior. Yeah, this is. I was not aware of how this works. Yeah. I tell you something about the literature. There is a paper of mine, What is Bounded Rationality, in a volume edited by Gigerenzer and myself. And there is a paper which has appeared in the Journal of Mathematical Psychology, 1989, about aspiration adaptation theory. And then also Features of Experimental Observed Bounded Rationality, European Economic Review, 1998. So for somebody who really wants to know more about this, these are hints to the literature. We begin with what I want to argue is that the current picture of full rationality is not feasible for people. I mean, full rationality requires, I look here at the mainstream version of what is thought to be full rationality as Bayesian subjective utility maximization. And this has serious difficulty. It is actually impossible for people, and I want to argue this. These are here experiments in this table done by Slovik, Fischhoff, and Liechtenstein in 1978, and they are concerned about probability judgments. And what they did, they presented, asked several people what is the probability that a starting failure of a car would result from several causes. So there were, and these were people who knew about cars, mechanics, and so on. So there were the first kind of cause was the battery failure, the second start system, fuel system, ignition system, motor, mischief, or other. And what you can see is when all the categories are presented, then you get the lines in the first column in all categories. Then they presented to some other people only part of the categories. For example, they didn't mention start system here in selection one. They didn't mention start system, ignition system, and mischief. And then if people would form correct probability judgments, then there should be the same numbers here, and what is named, and other should be much bigger. But actually other was not as much bigger as it should be, then it should here be 61. Yeah? It should here be 47%, it's actually only 14%. All the categories which are here grew by about 40% if three categories were left out. Actually, they should stay the same, and here there should be 47% and not 14% if this would be consistent probability judgments. There is here this selection 2, where just those categories are left out which were in here, were not in the questionnaires, and there almost the same thing happens. Yeah? Here even the others should be 0.611. They go, those who are left in go proportionally up, but others also goes only proportionally up, and instead of 61%, you get only 23%. And what does it mean? It means that people form such judgments in an attention-guided way. Their attention is focused by what they see on the questionnaire, and they forget about things which are not there, and form their probability judgment mainly with the help of attention-guided factors, and this destroys the consistency which is assumed in Bayesian theory. One can say what they don't see doesn't come to their mind, out of view, out of mind. Yeah, I did this. I now touch something which is not in the center of this lecture, and this is human motivation. One important motivation of humans in economic situations is reciprocity. This means, roughly speaking, I do unto you as you do unto me. If somebody is friendly to me, then as a friendly action leads usually to a friendly response. This is positive reciprocity. There is also negative reciprocity. A hostile action leads to a hostile response. And here a problem arises. I mean, this motivational things can also be described by full rationality. I mean, if people have this inclination to act in a reciprocal manner, then that could also be an argument in this utility function, and theories like this have been worked out. But the problem here is that it is not always clear what is a friendly action or a hostile action or a neutral action. The behavior of the other people has to be interpreted in order to see whether it's friendly, hostile, or neutral. And this requires boundedly rational cognition. Here we have two forms of presenting. What is this? What can I do there? The prisoner's dilemma can be presented in the usual matrix form. You have here a left side. There is the matrix, the bi-matrix. You have the red player and the green player. So both have two strategies, red A, red B, or red green A and green B. And then both of them have, independently of each other, they don't see each other, to choose one of both strategies. And then if, for example, player one, the red player chooses A and the green player chooses B, then the red player gets 0 and the green player gets 4. The red player gets the red payoff and the green player gets the green payoff. So this is the usual way in which this is presented. But there's another way of presenting the same game. And this is here the so-called decomposed form. You say you can choose A and B. If you choose A, then you take 0 for yourself and give 3 to the other one. If you choose B, you take 1 for yourself and give her or him 0. Yeah? And this is completely the same. For example, if we both choose A, then I give him 3, he gives me 3, so, yeah? And we take nothing for ourselves, we get both 3. Or if I choose, red chooses B and green chooses A, then red gives nothing to B, and B gives, but takes 1 for himself, and he also gets 3 from green, so he gets 4. So it's completely the same game. But it's this decomposed form, the behavior is completely different. Brut has, in the 70s, made experiments about this. So the same game was played by the same people, I think 100 times, one after the other. And if you play it in this matrix form, you get, if they choose A, then this is called cooperation. There was maybe only 50% cooperation. But if you present it in the decomposed form, then you have 90% cooperation. So there is a dramatic effect of this presentation. It is very important how this is presented. And even if the consequences of behavior are completely the same in both cases, there's no difference. Now, how does it come about? It is quite easy. If you see that he has chosen A, then you say maybe in the matrix form, you say, if he has chosen A, no, he wanted to get 3, this is a good payoff, yeah? So you don't get the idea that he has chosen a friendly action so easily. Here in the decomposed form, this idea is very likely, because you say, oh, he has taken 0 for himself and given me 3. This is a very friendly, yeah? I have to reciprocate. I also have to take 0 and give 3. And there, in this way, cooperation is reached much more easily. It is the cognitive activity, the thinking about the situation, which is guided by such presentation. Today it is mostly called framing. And and now I go to back to this. I want to say that, as I have shown, human probability judgments are heavily influenced by attention-guiding factors. And the same is true for preference judgments. I mean, also preference judgments are heavily guided by attention-gathering factors. Weber, Eisenführer, Winterfeld in Management Science 1988 showed that in a multi-attribute utility measurement, I mean, you describe alternatives to people by many dimensions, and if you split one dimension, for example, you split health into protection against infections and protection against other diseases, then suddenly health gets much more weight, yeah, in the utility measurement. Splitting a dimension increases, splitting attributes increases their weight in multi-attribute utility measurements. They are very strong effects of this. This means that people do not have preferences when they come to the task. They have to construct them in some way. And the construction of preferences is heavily influenced by attention-guiding factors. And so if you want to base your decision-making on probability judgments and preference judgments, you are on shaky grounds. You are living in a house built on sand. It's not feasible to do this if people are so bad in making these judgments. So I would contest the idea of modern decision theory, not only from the descriptive point of view, but also from the normative point of view for that reason. Now, if modern decision theory, the maximization of expected utility, does not describe behavior, how is now, what, how can we think of decision making in reality? Now, I have a rough picture of this. I don't have a full theory, a full boundedly rational decision theory, but I have a rough picture. The decision making begins with a superficial analysis of the situation. The human being sees a task, a decision task before him, maybe in the laboratory, and he begins with a superficial analysis. For example, he sees the profit table and there are profits in it and losses, and he says, well, I want to at least make a profit. I don't want to make a loss. And that is the beginning of his analysis. You can manipulate the situation as this, that you give him more initial assets and less profits in the time of the experiments. Yeah? And do not change the relationship between strategy and behavior, but it has great effects on behavior because behavior starts with a superficial analysis. And this, then you can go on in two ways. One is goal construction. This means you construct a goal. Like, for example, you want to have no losses. You want to have positive profit. And then from there, you think about how to do this, how to reach this goal. Then you go to the choice construction. The other way is the direct choice construction. In some cases, it is possible to see a qualitative relationship between the task and the decision behavior, reasonable decision behavior, and then go to the direct choice construction. This will become clear when I go to an example. The example is the following one. It is allocation of money or probability. It is in a paper by Looms, 1998, we have done related experiments before that, and but his experiments are very sharply making the point. So I present them here rather than our own experiments. The idea in money, the first task is money allocation. He tells us there are two events. One has the probability 65%, the other has the probability of 15%. And then you can put money on these, can bet on this, you can put, you get 20 winning chances and you can put X on this and 20 minus X on that. You have to choose X. Yeah? You could, for example, say, I put everything on 60 on the A, or I put half of it here, or something else. Yeah, so you can choose this as you like. And then there is another task, which is the probability allocation task. It is quite similar. Again, there are two bags, A and B, in which you have to put green balls or white balls. Now, the white balls are here in black, no? Because I can't write in white. No? But the green balls are written in green. Hmm? So you can put in here, you can put X green balls or 20 minus X white balls. And here 20 minus X green, you have to put, you get 20 white balls and 20 green balls, and you have to distribute them to the two bags. And then this 65% bag A is selected, yeah, by a random mechanism, and with 35% probability B is selected by a random mechanism, and then from the bag which is selected, one ball is drawn, yeah, and if it is green, you get 20 pounds. If it is white, you get nothing. So that is the whole story about this. And from the point of view of Bayesian decision makers, the tasks are very different. Yeah? Because here, in this case, you would say, well, you have to maximize subjective utility, and maybe you have a curvature in your utility function. It's understandable that you don't want to put everything on A. Yeah? If, for example, you have a logarithmic utility function, then you should put maybe 13 on A and 7 on B. No? But in this case, it is completely different. Here, whatever your utility is, there are only two possible outcomes. Either you get the 20 pounds or you don't get them. And what you have to maximize by Bayesian ideas is the probability to get the 20 pounds. And that means that you have to put everything 20 on this. So from the Bayesian point of view, these tasks are very different. But from the point of view of the subjects in this experiment, they are not very different. You get these distributions of what people do in both cases. Right? Yeah? The first is the money task here. And this is the probability allocation task. This is the money allocation task and probability. So these distributions are very similar. There is no significant difference between them. And in both cases, the mode of the distribution is to put 13 pounds on A and here to put 13 green balls in bag A and 7 in bag B. And how could this be understood? Now, the reasoning of the people is the same in both cases, actually. They would say, well, let me first look at the money task. I say, I can put, I don't want to put nothing on B, yeah, because it's very bad to get nothing if B is selected. And I don't want to put everything on A. And I also know that I have to put more on A if the probability of A is bigger. So I put something there which is proportional to the probability. So 13 to 7 is the same as 65 to 35. Yeah? So therefore they put 13. There are other people here, for example, who say, well, I should put more on A, but I should, and therefore I'd go into the middle between 10 and 20. I put 15 on it. And the same occurs here. I will say, well, I don't want to put no green ball into B because then I get nothing if B is drawn. Yeah? And I have to put more, the more into bag A, the higher the probability is. So I put 13 of these balls into bag A and 7 into bag B. The reasoning process of the people is very similar in both tasks, and they come to the same conclusion, even if, from the point of view of orthodox decision theory, these are completely different tasks. And here you have what I called the direct choice construction. You embed the problem in a larger space of problems. You would say, well, the probability for A and B could be different. And if they would be different, I would always put the more on A, the higher the probability is, and I choose a proportionality rule, and that gives me here 13 and 7. So there is no goal formation, there is a direct construction of the choice rule. Now I come to the goal construction. Goal construction by aspiration adaptation. And this is a paper which has been written about an econometric model of the ground coffee market by Gruka, Sudarshan, and Kumar in 1999. I don't know whether they have published it. It is always very difficult. It takes often many years. This was a working paper. Yeah? But it's very well written. They looked at a local regional market for ground coffee, and they took into account all brands with at least 1% market share. And all these were produced by two firms. One was Procter & Gamble, which produced Folgers Flaked, Shays, and Sanborn. These three brands, and General Food produced Maxwell House, Sanka Brim, Master Blend. Master Blend was the new introduced brand. I mean, before they had only Maxwell House, Sanka, and Brim, and then they introduced Master Blend. Now, this introduction of a new brand into the system is, of course, a serious matter for marketing people in these firms, and one has to look at how they should, according to ordinary, to the theory, respond to this. These authors made a very good model of demand. I will not go into this. And then they also assumed that the brand managers would compete with each other, even if they are in the same firm. This is actually the case. I mean, the big firms encourage their brand managers to compete with each other. And so you have to treat the brands as players and not the firms. Now, how would they then respond? They could change price, advertising, and distribution spending, three variables. And they set up in game theoretic models for that and computed the Nash equilibrium prediction and the Nash equilibrium before and after, and it would say that after the introduction of the new brand, the incumbent brands would decrease price, decrease advertising, and decrease distributional spending for all the three brands. But actually, this didn't happen. The Procter & Gamble brands increased advertising and distributional spending. They also decreased price, but they also increased, that was correctly predicted. but they increased advertising and distributional spending. And otherwise, there were correct directions. Now, how is this interpreted? The authors interpreted this based on aspiration adaptation theory. This means that these firms, these brand managers, do not have a single goal. They have two goals, two goal variables for each brand, profit and sales. And if there is a difficulty in the market, there's a new brand in it, they have to decide. They cannot keep up both goals at the same level. They have to decide where to adjust their aspirations. They have to lower their aspirations in some case, some way. And General Food brand managers reduces their sales aspirations. I mean, they have, of course, a new brand, which gives more sales, and so they were maybe told from above to reduce their sales aspirations. And Procter & Gamble defends the sales aspiration. So that means they want to make the sale, the same sales as before, even if they lose profit by that. Yeah? Whereas the others maybe reduce the sales and want to make the same profits as before. So in this way, they responded differently. And if you look at a modified Nash equilibrium with profit maximization for General Food brands, but constrained profit maximization for Procter & Gamble brands, then this becomes in qualitative agreement with the data. I mean, the responses in this kind of modified model are the same as you observed. I mean, qualitatively, it's not exactly the same numbers which come out, but qualitatively it goes in the same direction. Now here, the decision task was solved by first forming goals in a natural manner. You have to, you cannot keep both of the goals you had before, you have to adjust one to the below, and this was then done in a certain manner. Now I come to, I already said, I now come to another subject of bounded rationality, and this is qualitative reasoning. Qualitative reasoning is very important in economic life. You say that you talk about the effects, of, for example, of lowering the price. You say if the price is lowered, then we will sell more. Yeah, but then maybe also our profit. Then you have to decide what is more important. And if you have a lower price and to sell more, you could have a higher profit. You could also have a lower profit. Yeah. And you have to decide what is more important, whether the effect of having selling a higher quantity is more important for your profit, or whether the effect of having a lower unit profit is more important for your profit. But this is then mainly done qualitatively, and I will further explain how this is done. Here I look at a paper which has been written by Rick Thomas in Newsweek on January 8, 1990. And in this paper, they argue about tax incentives for savings. In the beginning, the problem is explained. The US savings rate is very low in comparison to Germany and Japan. And therefore, the question arises, do we need tax incentives for savings? The American savings plan was then instituted, and actually quite successfully. But then the argument in this paper is the following. Here you if you introduce tax incentives for savings, I follow first the main argument here, which is then this has a positive effect on savings. Yeah? And then this has, if savings is increased, this has a positive effect on investable funds. So if more is saved, then more can be invested. Yeah, there's more funds there. And also it has a negative interest on a negative effect on the interest rate. And both these effects will then come to more investment. I mean, here it's clear, more savings, more investment, more investable funds, more investment. Here it is more savings, lower interest rate, and lower interest rate will be negatively connected to investment, but this means that there will be more invested. Yeah? If the interest rate is lower, then investment is higher. And this is that the movements go in opposite direction is here then represented by a minus sign. But then there is a third effect. And this is that if savings is increased, consumption will be decreased. Yeah? And that will be have a negative effect on growth because consumption is positively connected to growth. And then you have to make a decision with what is here more important. And in the article, the argument is, or at least the argument attributed to economists, is that this is less important. So tax incentives for saving will have a positive influence on growth. And then there are also objections are discussed. And also some remarks about the causal relationships. For example, one reason they talk about why this situation came about, that the American US savings rate is very low. They said that pension plans, etc., make it less necessary to save for old age, and therefore savings is going down. Now that's a dubious argument, but it's not my purpose here to criticize these arguments, but to see how the structure of thinking is. But nevertheless, let me say why it is a dubious argument. And at that time, at least in Japan, I don't know so much about Japan, but in Germany, the pension system was much better. Yeah, and much more secure than here. Nevertheless, people saved more. Yeah? This is not, yeah? This argument is not so. Then there were other people who said that if you now give tax incentives for savings, you will have less, the state will have less income, then this will result in delayed budget deficits, and that is a bad effect. So this was the objection that growth is not only the only variable which you should look at. There are other goals like this one. Then there was another thing which said the proportion of old is growing in the population, and older people save more, so the problem will go away by itself. Yeah? This is also an objection. And then there was here another objections, this means, well, if you talk about savings, you should not talk only about savings of private people, but also of the state. The state should raise taxes or cut spending, and that would maybe lead to more saving in the economy. And another thing is, as somebody else said, yes, American savings are not important for American investment, because the investment in America comes largely from outside. It's done by foreign people. And and this is also here shown in this diagram. So the diagram shows everything which is in this paper. I just give you some quotations which you find in the paper. One first is, savings regardless where deposited act is a pool of money that businesses can tap for new plants, equipment, and employees. And this is what is here. This is here. Yeah. And no, we are not yet here. So. Greater savings keep interests lower. That was also in the diagram. Because of these advantages, one and two, most economists dismiss the commonly held view that curbing consumption would drag the economy into a recession. So there was a qualitative judgment, according to him, made by economists, that the consumption argument is less important. Then the fourth thing is about this foreign investment. John Makin of the American Enterprise Institute says that the rest of the world is saving so much in investing in this country that the US savings rate isn't as relevant as before. Now I come to the next subject, and this is prominence in the decimal system. There is an important paper by Albers and Albers, 1983, and a book is coming out by Albers. He has already had the manuscript in 99, but it's he still revised it again and again, and that is about processing of numbers, boundedly rationality, rational processing of numbers. The idea is that if you have a decimal number, it can be more round or less round. We say more prominent or less prominent. Yeah? And that plays a role also for prices and for many things. This prominence is very important. I come to this. Let X be a decimal number with a positive finite number of non-zero digits. Yeah? It's not an infinite, but a positive number of non-zero digits. And such a number has a unique representation. X equals K, 10 to the eta, to the power eta, with K integer, where K is an integer with at last digit J unequal to zero. The last digit which is unequal to zero counts. And eta is also an integer. And the exactant of X is a number delta times 10 to the eta, where delta is 5 if the last digit is 5. Yeah? The last, yeah, then, for example, if you have 105, then the exactness of this would be 5. Then it is delta equals 2 if it is one of the numbers 2, 3, 7, 8. The idea here is it is not, the exactness is not 5. And 2 is something like 0 plus 2, and 5 plus minus 2 is 2 is 3 or 7. Yeah, it is, and 8 is 10 minus 2. And then the other numbers 1, 4, 6, 9 have only the exactness of 1. Yeah? So that is the definition of exactness. And people make a decision often in a way that they do it by qualitative reasoning and they stop at a level of exactness where they cannot go on further. For example, here, how many inhabitants has, for example, Cairo? Yeah? Ask somebody, what will he do? How will he solve this task? He will say, well, these cities have the inhabitants, number of inhabitants is between 0 and 20 million. Yeah. And I asked myself first, is it more than 10 million or less than 10 million? Yeah. Then it comes to the conclusion, oh, it's less than 10 million. Then he asks himself, is it more than 5 million or less than 5 million? Yeah. And here he comes to the conclusion that it is more than 5 million. So then he goes to the next lower prominence level, 7, he says. Is it less than 7 or more than 7? Yeah. Then he says, well, it's less than 7, and then he comes to the 6, and then he has no good reason anymore, yeah, to make it more exact, and he says it's 6. Yeah. So that is the way in which such decisions tend to be made. And prominence plays a great role here. Prominence also plays a great role if, for example, the central bank, for example, the Fed, makes a decision about the interest rate. There, a prominent interest rate is something divisible by 0.25%. Yeah, this always goes in quarters. If they increase the interest rate, will invariably be 0.25% or 0.5%. Very rarely it happens 0.75% or 0.5%. Mostly it's 0.25%. I mean, the last interest hikes in the, yeah, of the Fed were always every few weeks there was a new interest hike by 0.25. And the main question which is discussed by these people is whether they should increase the interest rate or not, or whether they should not increase it, or whether they should lower it. And once they have decided, this is a very conventional thing, to just increase it by 0.25, unless people feel so strongly that this is too little, yeah, then you have to go to 0.5 and so on. So this is then done completely conventional on the basis of prominence and not on the basis of calculation. Now I come to another subject, and this is strategic reason without circular concepts. Game theory is full of circular concepts. This is really the beauty of game theory, is that you deal with circular concepts like equilibrium or quotas, yeah, or yeah, the von Neumann-Morgenstern solution, just to mention them. They are all, yeah, in a way circular. But people do not engage much in this circular reasoning. They attack the problem in another way. For example, we look here at three-person coalition games without the grand coalition. So there are three players, and they can a two-person coalition can be formed. Either one and two can form and together divide A among themselves, or one and three together divide B, and two and C, and they can divide C among themselves. And who doesn't get into a coalition which stays alone gets zero. Now here's an example, it's 80, 50, 70. Yeah? Now, the traditional way of solving this is the quotas, let's say. Yeah? There is a concept which is a very simple, a cooperative concept of the quotas, which is in a way circular. You say, there are three numbers, Q1, Q2, Q1, Q3, such that Q1 plus Q2 is A, Q1 plus Q3 is B, and Q2 plus Q3 is C. So in every coalition, everybody gets his quota, and then there will be a stability because nobody could get more in another coalition. So, but this requires that everybody, if he enters the coalition, gets his quota. And this is in this case that Now what is this? Well, this is wrong here. There should be no Q1. Here this. There is just wrong here. No? What I mean, I should forget about this. What is on the left side? I don't know. I have it. Why is this crept in here? It is that the quota of the first player is 50, that of the second is. The quota of the first player is 50, the second is 30, and the third is 20. So if he gets. And he goes with the third, then they divide 50, 20. Yeah? If he goes with the second, they divide 50, 30. And they go, they divide 30, 20. These are the quotas. But actually, what people do is somewhat different. They go by order. The first thing that people see here is that one is stronger than two, and two is stronger than three. Yeah? So they will say first, one is the strongest, and then the coalition of one and two is the most attractive one. And then if this coalition is formed, then player one has to get at least half of it. And player two cannot claim half of it because he is weaker than player one, but he is stronger in the coalition with the third player. And there he can. So he should get at least 25. And there are then lower bounds for the two players. For this is E half, and the other is C half. But then there are also upper bounds. If you can get it, player one can get at most A minus S2, and he can get at most A minus S1. Yeah? And then there is the player three, the poor player three, who has to attract one of the players, and he has to adjust to a low aspiration level, and so he will have to get the minimum of what he can get with player one minus H1, or what he can get with player two minus his highest thing. Yeah? And if you do this, you get here S1 is 40, S2 is 24, and S3 is 10. In the example. Yeah, I'm not sure whether this was correctly. Yeah. And we have analyzed many games of this kind. There's, already at 20 years ago, there was a big literature, and we have analyzed this and formed. Looked at all the games played at that time. And the quotas are connected to the bargaining set. And the bargaining set, of course, people do not exactly take the quotas. They may deviate five. Yeah? And if you, and that improves the prediction of the bargaining set. If you allow some deviations of 5 points, and then the bargaining set has a measure of predictive success of 0.19. The measure is hit rate minus relative area size. Which, I mean, such an area theory can predict more or less, and then you have to subtract the area size. But equal division payoff bounds has a hit rate minus area size of 0.64. Yeah? It is much superior to this. This was based on 25 independent data sets from the literature. So then, as a last example, I go to explain an experiment on what we call measure for measure. That is a study by myself, Mitzkiewicz and Ulich, 1997. And the game which was analyzed was a 20 times repeated asymmetric quantity duopoly with numerically specified linear cost and demand. Now, what is this? An oligopoly is a market in which here it is a duopoly actually, in which there are few firms on the market, yeah? In this case, only two firms of the market on the market. And this is the quantity duopoly. So they both have to produce something, and then this is sold at the market, maybe at an auction. Yeah? So there is one price for what they offer. And one of the duopolies had high fixed costs and low marginal costs. The other had low fixed costs and high marginal costs. And so this was asymmetric. And we had this whole experiment took half a year, the whole semester, no, maybe 4 months, let's say. It was the whole winter semester. The players were 24 participants of a student seminar. And they had the task, they first had three game playing rounds. They played the game three times, yeah, and gained some experience. And then they had to program strategies for the game. They would not play themselves anymore, but they would have to write a program which would then play against the other programs of the other people. And then there were these three game playing rounds, then there are three strategy programming rounds. So after they had the first tournament, they played against each other, they got back the information about how the players, the computer printouts of how the games went, which they played, and then they would maybe change their strategies, yeah? And then have a new round, and then finally the third round. Because it would take 2 weeks at least to make this change and so on. So we evaluated the last strategies which were submitted, and they show a typical structure. The first thing which people understand is when they have the game playing experience is that you should cooperate, even if game theoretically it's not possible. Because you cannot cooperate in the last period, therefore you cannot cooperate in the second last period and so on, and so you come by induction to the conclusion that you cannot cooperate at all because you play exactly 20 periods, yeah, and they know this. And they also discussed this induction problem, but they were not convinced of this. They would say, we have to try to cooperate because otherwise we cannot make money. And it was not that they really made money because we could not possibly give them meaningful money payoffs. We paid them in grades. Yeah? So they got grades according to their performance, but to the absolute performance, not to the relative. We explained this before, that we would not give them grades to the absolute performance, but to the absolute performance, not to the relative one, and also to some extent to the documentation of their program and the reasons for this. And it turned out that this was very interesting, that there was a typical approach to the strategic problem. The first thing which somebody asks who has to write such a problem is usually, where do I want to cooperate? Suppose I say I should produce 5 and he should produce 3 or something like that. Yeah? So they form a quantity pair which is then called an ideal point. This is the answer to this. And how are these ideal points formed? They are based on various fairness criteria. For example, somebody could say, well, we should have both equal profits and then get the highest profits we can get. Or we should have profits proportional to the Cournot profit. They understood that the Cournot solution would be, yeah, the basic non-cooperative solution. We say, well, we should have proportional, or we should have, both of us should earn the same amount above the Cournot profits. No? These were the fairness criteria. Such fairness criteria gave rise to the ideal points. Sometimes also they may feel that this ideal point, which they had so high, and may adjust it in, yeah, from one tournament to the next. But basically, behind there were these fairness considerations behind them. And then the second question is then, how do I achieve cooperation? How do we, yeah? How do I get to these goals? It's again here a goal formation and then goal and then choice construction. Again here. Goal formation and then strategy construction. And there you take a measure for measure policy. You would say, if he goes nearer to my goal point, to the ideal point, I also go nearer. If he goes away from it, if he becomes more aggressive, I also become more aggressive to a similar extent. Now, what is a similar extent? This is different from person to person. It might be proportional the same amount or so. This is interpreted differently, but there is always this kind of measure for measure. To the same extent that you become more aggressive, I also become more aggressive, and so on. And there is a typical phase structure. I mean, the first four periods, they do not follow the measure for measure period. I mean, up to they cannot follow it in the first period anyhow. They need at least two periods in order to do this, because you have to see what the other did from the first to the second period. And then they can respond in this way. And so up to four periods, they begin with high quantities and then go down in the direction of their ideal point. Yeah? And then, from then on, they follow the measure for measure policy, and toward the end, up to four periods at the end, they act non-cooperatively. Mostly they play Cournot in this kind. So this is what they do. And what is important here is that they do not make any attempt to predict quantitatively the behavior of the other. Yeah? They say, if I follow my measure for measure policy, then he will obey, yeah? He will then adjust to it, and we will come to my ideal point. Of course, he also follows his measure for measure policy. Yeah? And then either it is compatible or not. Yeah? If it is compatible, we come to some kind of agreement. If not, we end in conflict at Cournot equilibrium. And this kind of playing this game is quite reasonable. It's very reasonable to form goals in this way and try to achieve them, yeah, and in this way, but it has nothing to do with traditional oligopoly theory or game theory, because there is no attempt to maximize a payoff given expectations about the other's, yeah, strategies and so on. Instead of having this passive attitude, you think about what the strategy of the other is and optimize against this, you take a more active attitude. You say, I do this and he should live with this. Yeah? So I try to push. And this is also what is recommended to parents in education and so on. You are not recommended to calculate what the child will do, yeah, and to optimize against this, but you should be consequent. So there is here no prediction and no optimization. Yeah, there is a goal formation and a choice construction, and not prediction and no optimization. And now, as the last thing, I go back to my picture about the structure of decision making revisited. First, there's superficially analysis and vague preferences, and now we look at the goal construction. We have seen that this might be done by aspiration adaptation, like in the case of the entry of master blend, or it might be done by equity or fairness, for example, in the equal division payoff bounds, or the ideal points in measure for measure. And then there comes the choice construction, either by qualitative reasoning in saving, not the American way. You then, And then in instrumental reciprocity, it might also be in measure for measure. That is similar to reciprocity, but it is instrumental. Yeah, you use it as an instrument, but that is. There is also the direct choice construction. You just look, embed the problem into a set of problems, and then look at a simple relationship, the most simple relationship between decision, and the variation of the problem. And that leads you to simple relationship, and that was done in the allocation of money or probability. And another way in which you can come to a direct choice construction is prominence. Begin with qualitative arguments and then come to some prominence number. I mean, you want to increase the interest rate, you increase it by the usual amount of 0.25%. So that is what I wanted to tell you. And I will finish my talk with this. Thank you very much.